I am Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast dedicated to creating the biographies of the people and the places that came and went before us that really had nothing to do with sport or politicians. I must admit, I'm a bit of a fan, and I've got somebody on the show today that I'm thrilled personally to have. One of my loves has always been finding books about things that I can obviously relate to, but books that are written about histories of the really hidden stuff, the really day-to-day, and the social histories. The author that I'm going to have on, my first book that I ever read of hers was quite a while ago, was A City Lost and Found, and it's a story about Whelan the Wrecker, who really did take down half, if not half more, of the most incredible imperial colonial kind of buildings. He was an actual wrecker. And also another book that I've read of hers is Fly a Rebel Flag, which is very much Eureka Stockade based, which my own family does share a little bit of heritage from. I'm, of course, talking about the incredible author, Robin Anir. Welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Roy. Great to be here.
It's a thrill to have you. But what I am going to do is put upon you to give us some of the insights as to some of the interesting crookery that you've come across in your, that's a technical word, I don't expect you to be able to keep up, the shifty crookery of those amazing people that I don't know what it is that makes their creativity lean towards illegal activity, but surely in your huge amounts of hours you've come across some of those stories. I'd love to hear about them.
I spent a lot of time crawling around in old newspapers, courtesy of Trove, in putting together my podcast, and just because it's my natural environment, I love to be there. And there is no avoiding these sort of crooks once you start scratching the surface of any sort of carny crowd. Or you don't even go looking for them. You don't even realise they're carny folk. You know, they're being booked for some small crime, and next thing you know, you discover they're a ventriloquist, and that their brother's a juggler, and that their other brother, and they all go, nobody goes by their right name, and they dwell so, the meshing between small crookery and you know, the carnival crowd, or even the vaudeville crowd, is that membrane is so thin that just so often seems to be a connection between those two. Now, maybe it's just that the work is uncertain and the income likewise uncertain, or maybe it's, you know, maybe there's a craving for excitement and living on the edge that goes with both those things, and that lends itself to small crime of the exciting sort. So I do come across those folk an awful lot.
I was talking with a couple of different historians recently, and we talked about the kind of a distinguishing factor between a lot of earlier criminals who you could argue were committing crimes of necessity for survival, crime of survival.
Yeah. Yep.
And is it that we don't see them today so readily because it's so comfortable?
Well, there's a safety net, and there wasn't a safety net. You know, there really wasn't. I'm in the 19th century, most of my research, and that safety net was not there. You know, it was a very thin safety net. You wouldn't call it that. The people wanted to avoid, and that was the one associated with charity and everything that went with that. And that was not a place that people wanted to dwell if they possibly could. So, no, there was no safety net. And you had things like the benevolent home system, where if you got too old or too sick or too poor, you might end up being accepted into a benevolent home. But it was, you know, it was next to being a prison. And it was held up as an example to people of avoid this place if you can, just as they would do with prisons. Here in my town, Castlemaine, we have the prison on one hill and the benevolent home, now the hospital, on another. And it was up on the hill for a reason. It was exemplified as a place apart and a place to, you know, that you would point out to your children and say, you don't want to end up there. So that was the sort of place for women, particularly, who, you know, we see the kind of Little Lon situations in Melbourne, in Little Lon and Little Bourke streets, that how they were packed with small, you wouldn't even call them brothels, but just opportunistic kind of brothel situations. Women had very little choice about whether they ended up in that life, because, like I say, their alternatives were, if they were lucky, and it wasn't really much luck, the benevolent home or the river A lot of them ended up in the Yarra. And, you know, these were just women who were unlucky. Their husbands left them or died or they never had a husband. And without that, without the sturdiness of an income-earning man, they were, you know, they had nothing.
My own Nana was dropped off at an orphanage at the age of four. And it was a Catholic-run orphanage and she was raised by the nuns. And she conveyed to me that one of the nuns told her, we always build our churches on top of hills. So if you try and run away, we can see you running down the hill. It's quite a looming, ominous kind of.
Yeah.
And with our necessity being the mother of all creation, there is also an aspect I find that life was so different 100 years ago, even down to the language. And do you come across in your research instances where people are doing things, horses would be a good example, where we don't have daily access, at least to horses. There were people interacting with them daily, hourly, you know, but then that transfers to the crime. The crimes they would commit then involve things that we just don't come in contact with now.
Exactly. And that we wouldn't think of as having any value, but when they were related to whether, you know, the theft of a horseshoe, for instance, why would you do that? You just might, if you found your horse without one, you know, what would that do to some, potentially to someone's livelihood or whatever? So, crime associated with something like you're talking about, it wouldn't even cross our minds now. And in researching the history of secondhand clothes and seeing the convergence in particularly the early 19th centuries between secondhand clothes dealers and crime, they were often dealing in stolen stuff and getting transported to Australia, for instance. I came to understand, you know, that old saw about, oh, they were transported for stealing a handkerchief or something of that sort, or a pair of trousers or a hat. The value of those things was beyond our imagining. People might only have one suit of clothes, and to have their shirt or something stolen from the clothesline or their trousers, you know, it could be the difference between whether they could go to work or not. There was a lot of value in even a handkerchief, and I came to understand that. So, yeah, crime is not the way you think it is, looking in the rear vision mirror. And writing Bear Brass, my first book about Melbourne in the period before the gold rush, one thing I was especially aware of there was the influence of alcohol on the settlement and on its inhabitants. So admittedly, again, I was resorting a lot to criminal files and also newspaper records, but and they're awash in small crime. But just the fighting between neighbours, both female and male, the fighting between neighbours and, of course, domestic partners, and just the amount of crime, nearly all of it, that was fueled by grog was just unbelievable. And this comes down to where the title of my podcast, which is called Nothing on TV, comes from, because I have so often said, long before my podcast came into being, I've so often said to people, so much that happened in the histories that I write about can be explained simply by the fact there was nothing on TV. People had big families. Kids were out on the streets at night. Small crime, drinking too much, being out at the pub, fighting, whatever. What bliss to be able to turn on the TV and a couple who really were antagonistic to one another and had far too many children could then sit down in relative peace and have a shared neutral experience that was just not available to them in the 19th century. So, you know, I think TV is our saviour.
with myself having six children, I did say to Mrs. Me recently, I said to her, George Orwell hit the nail on the head when he said, we'll all be pacified and we'll just stare at screens. And I reckon my children, no matter how big the gain is, they would be too invested in Minecraft to commit a crime. You'd have to, like, you know, we say everybody's got a price. And I think that's changed in the generations. Yeah. And I think my children's price, I mean, my price growing up was, honestly, was a free coffee and a fully charged Mikey ticket. nowadays, it's considerably more. The ingenuity of criminals, I came across recently an article about a fellow in 1919, and he was given prison time for carrying a leather truncheon up his sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
He was loitering with malicious intent. In your research, do you come across things that are charged and prosecutable that would never raise an eyebrow today?
Well, just all the different ways that you could charge someone with, what did they call it, loitering or the word is escaping me.
Behavior comes.
You know, just not having a home. The vagrancy. Number of people who were charged with vagrancy, and it covered a multitude of things. It covered prostitution, for instance, could be vagrancy if you were on the streets without a good reason, or not having money in your pockets or whatever. So the huge catch-all that vagrancy was is something that's not such a – I'm sure it's still part of some people's lives today, but I don't know how much that's employed. That was a big thing, was vagrancy, and particularly towards children, you know, children whose parents weren't there to take care of them, so were either found on the streets or even in their own homes or anywhere without their parents, could be locked away for vagrancy because, you know, for their own protection. But that could just be an endless slide into misery.
I do have a personal love or soft spot, I'll say, an understanding, not a condolence, an understanding for the typically males, but they're in an era of, I want to say con men, but I want to be more sympathetic. They were men who created a sensation that was, they normally sold something so impossible, but by the time you got the product, the good ones didn't give you the product they said they were going to give you, but it was so good anyway that you didn't complain.
Yeah. One of these that I always remember is the guy who had a sideshow at the Eastern Market, I don't know, late 19th century, with the placard out the front, come in, it was a tent, come in and see the man-eating shark, and you'd pay your penny or whatever it was, go inside and there would be a man eating a plate of flake. It was a man-eating shark. And again, like you say, you'd go, oh, how stupid am I? But you kind of, it was worth it, I reckon, for the, despite the come now.
That was a heck of a place. And the Haymarket area that's no longer there. And there was a horse bazaar off Little Bourke Street.
Yep.
And then obviously the Eastern Market. Am I wrong in thinking that's where the Southern Cross Hotel once stood?
Southern Cross, that's right. Yep.
Near Parliament Inn. Ironically, that whole hub there where the Easter Market was, directly across from the Salvation Army building was a pair of streets called Romeo Lane Juliet Terrace. I don't think they've had enough airplay. But that very short bits of real estate that were thronging with criminal activity.
Yeah. And behind them, on the other side of Little Bourke Street, was a street which never really existed. It was a network of nameless lanes for quite a while, nameless, that was known as Bilking Square. And it was an informal sort of offshoot. And that was the worst. That was the seen as the feeder to Romeo Lane and Juliet Terrace. And there was a whole bunch of really seedy hotels that they used to call dead houses. In the lane there. I think they were called dead houses, not because people were always getting killed there. My understanding of a dead house was it was a kind of a room or a shed out the back where you could sleep it off. And that was the dead house. But anyway, the whole scene associated with those lanes and Bilking Square was just, you know, so seedy. I had a great, great, great grandfather who was a missionary who used to work, a Melbourne missionary, an inner city missionary who used to work that. That was his beat. And his diaries are in the University of Melbourne archives. And they're so pathetic because he would go and he'd sit with a poor woman who didn't even have a stick of furniture. So he'd be sitting on the floor, presumably. She had nothing. Her husband had left her with, you know, however many kids. She had nothing. And all he had to offer her was one of his little tracts with some prayers on it. And he would note in his diary, said what seemed best.
Oh, gosh.
That was it. So he, you know, he knew in a, on a granular level what these lives were like, but he had nothing he could do for them. He really had nothing.
We link stories there a little bit. My parents, all four grandparents and great grandparents were Salvation Army officers.
Right.
And they all centered around that building at 69.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, yeah. My grandmother was born 1919.
Uh-huh.
And she would name the race of every person in every story. And she would often give these condolences like, but of course, you know, he's one of those queers. Or and they wanted, there was assimilation need for everybody to solve anxiety by being the same.
The same, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, that was the same even with my mother's generation where they talk about it, but of course they're a Catholic, you know. I mean, that sort of, that need to point out the difference from yourself was just integral. But you're right, with someone who came from a missionary background, you know, every encounter they had would have been based around how that person was different from them and could be improved, could be smoothed out and made proper.
Well, let's talk about us and them. How heavily does us and them feature in the aggressive side of history?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'm glad you said
that. I'm not sure. Say some more about that, Roy.
Yeah, so the us and them, the Catholic, the Protestant, the gay and the straight, and the...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Those dichotomies.
Even the side of town you live on is still present today in some ways. How do you find that that features in... where you would be on a certain day, whether you can play sport on a Sunday, whether you can...
Well, I mean, I've got to say that the us and thems that stand out to me most in my readings and research are between the poor and the wealthy, with that gap as huge, if not huger than it is now, the sort of discrepancy between those extremes. So there's that, and the commentary that went with that, which was always, as you say, how can we make these people decent? How can we make them respectable? Not so much because we want to know them or we want to mix with them, but they're an eyesore and an embarrassment to us and a blight on our fine city in the case of Melbourne. So that us and them was just, is just there all the time, and just seemed unbridgeable for so long. The other us and them that I'm always aware of is the male-female us and them, because to me, I can identify so much more with 19th century Victorian men than I can with women, because they have similar freedoms and what have you that I have, as I have now. But the women are such a mystery to me in many ways, because I try and, you know, it's really easy, and a lot of commentators, modern historians and so on, seem to do this, to say, if I had been a woman then, I would have acted in a different, I would have stood up against oppression, or I would have stood up against injustice. But I struggle with the idea of what it must have been like to be born a woman and born into the expectations and the constraints that a 19th century woman had, even one who potentially, you know, was entitled to a good education and all those sorts of things. They came out the other end with no choice other than marrying, basically. And, you know, that us and them is always there for me. Even the most enlightened men, and in my research I've met some fantastic men, men I would have loved to know, men I would have loved to marry. You know, I really fall in love with some of my subjects, these terrific Renaissance men who used to, like Alfred Howitt, the mine surveyor and lands department guy who was based down in Bruthen, I think, in East Gippsland. And he was the son of the Howitt husband and wife who used to write for Charles Dickens magazine. And they came out here during the gold rushes. Father went home and Alfred stayed. And he was the guy who rode off into the desert to rescue Burke and Wills, found their bodies. But he was an enlightened human being. He spent a lot of time with Indigenous people down in East Gippsland and had huge respect and exchange with them. And he was a sort of anthropologist in that way. He recorded Indigenous language and published it. He used to read on horseback, and he was into music and minor dramatics and all sorts of things. He was a fantastic human being. I loved him. But you still find, and he and his friends, there was this gulf between them and the women in their lives that could never be bridged, even with their enlightened outlook on life. One of his friends, James Sterling of Omeo, another mine surveyor, was very enlightened again. He had daughters and sons, and he insisted that his daughters would not be taught to sew unless his sons also were. But, you know, in the end, he could not create lives for his daughters that didn't yet exist. So I feel the sting of that so strongly when I reach back into history. And you know, I'm pained when I still see the remnants of the discrepancies between men and women and their opportunities. So, yeah, that's one that stings me.
It makes me wonder then, I digress a little bit, but sort of related, what made you interested in Will and the Wrecker? What was your first interaction with that? Because that is a fascinating topic, but not one we consider very quickly.
I grew up in the 1960s in the suburbs of Melbourne, and my family used to get every day the Herald and the Sun, two different newspapers in those days, and fantastic illustrated newspapers. Photos were such a big part of them, which is what I loved about them. And it seemed like every day, almost, probably wasn't, but it seemed like every day I'd read a story about what Wheel and the Wrecker was wrecking now in Melbourne. And you can believe it was literally true. And they seemed to me, I didn't even know what an archaeologist was then, but had I known, I would have thought that they were archaeologists because they seemed to be digging stuff up. You know, there were always these terrific stories about what they found when they were pulling a building down or digging some hole. So I loved that. You know, they were just go-to guys for a bit of colour in the paper. There were journalists on both those newspapers who would go out and find wherever Whelan was pulling a building down and say, what's the story you can tell us today, when they had a gap in the paper. So I grew up reading that. It must be one of the things I can attribute my love of history to, and particularly that sort of the tangibility of history, that, you know, you can uncover it literally, physically. And my interest in archaeology. So it's that. That's what got me into it. And I sort of followed their career. And then 1991, at the end of 1991, that was when they went bust. And I figured that Keith Dunstan, a veteran journalist from The Sun, who always used to write about Whelan and the Wrecker and clearly loved the guys, I figured that he would write the book about Whelan and the Wrecker. And he didn't. He never did. So you know, years passed and I took up the subject, and, you know, it was such fun. It was such a different way to get under the skin of Melbourne.
It's strange when we know that there are such historical giants I will say I'm very patriotic as Australian, but we have been horrible storytellers. If we were Americans, we would have movies about Big Chief, Little Wolf, Mario Milano, Jimmy Sharman. I mean, like full blockbuster movies with Russell Crowe, I have no doubt. But, and if you're listening, Russell, give me the funding. I can make any of these. But is there a story that you, what would be your story that you think really deserves that kind of Hollywood blockbuster airplay?
That kind of epic telling. I don't know if I can put my finger on one. There's probably several I could choose from, but it would be one of the many stories I've come upon in Australian history about fluid identity, about, you were talking about showman before, your classic professor, somebody they would call themselves, and they'd be have a kind of medicine show where they'd be reading the bumps on people's heads and peddling some crappy medicine and giving talks to men about men's things, you know, only men could attend the lectures, and so they had this racy side to them. And they were always Americans. They always hailed from Kentucky or God knows where, Georgia, wherever, usually in the South. And so many of these guys turned out to be from Sheffield in Tasmania or from the suburbs of Melbourne or something. And I love those stories. There are many of them, but some of them have a fantastic epic sprawl to them. And one of the things I'd love to know, and I don't think this wouldn't really work in a movie, but I could actually with Russell Crowe. He does a pretty good American accent, but maybe you do a really bad one, because one thing I've always wondered is, what did their accents sound like when they put on these American accents? What do people expect an American to sound like then, do you think? If right. a guy who hailed from Sheffield in Tasmania could just suddenly decide to become a Yank and spend the rest of his life telling people he's American and passing himself off as one, I wonder what he sounded like and why people thought his accent was a convincing, you know, hallmark of Americanness. So I think there'd be a movie that would be both funny, and Russell Crowe would be terrific again. You know, we're assuming that he is listening to this, and I think that's probably a pretty fair bet.
Nothing better to
it's
do.
It's a pretty fair bet. He could be listening to this, and he could do this brilliantly. So he could do a really sham American accent, and he's got the swagger for it. So these guys had swagger in abundance, and if they were really lucky, and I know of one of these stories where this was the case, they would meet their match in some female who was just waiting to go down that twisty path with them. And I know, as I say, of one story that just goes bananas. The woman ends up being the chief shyster and passing herself off as a trained nurse who ran a private hospital, and I think used to trade hugely in abortions, but also I think probably nurse vulnerable and old people, and then somehow convince them to leave everything to her in their wills and things like this. She was absolutely shameless. And this pair, the professor who did the medicine show and his wife, they were formidable. You could really go to town with a story like that. And there are so many of those stories just waiting to scratch the surface.
I was talking with my partner recently, and we were talking about accents, actually, and the change in Australian accents over a 100-year period, when we've got our early recordings, and I don't know for sure. I just have a feeling that comes to do with television and Americanization in our vernacular, because further out in the country you get, where there was arguably less media, there is now a discernible accent difference. I'm reading a lot about Squizzy Taylor at the moment. And his best mate, Henry Stokes, you know, he was English, and he would have had an English accent.
Yeah.
And that only occurred to me literally today. People say to me, I get this question a lot, where would you go to in history if you could time machine travel? You know, I wouldn't. That's my answer. This is a great. But I wonder if I could even be understood fluently 100 years
ago. Yes. Yeah. It's a fascinating question, isn't it? What the Australian accent, what an Australian accent sounded like.
Now, you're from Castlemaine. Could you get around Castlemaine 100 years ago speaking how you speak now? Dressing.
Even that, yeah. Now, see, it's interesting you even say Castlemaine, because we say Castlemaine. In fact, there's a bumper sticker here in town that says there is no R in Castlemaine. So, you know, that's a Victorian accent that comes from the Northern English influence, as well as the Irish, the castle instead of the castle. And Victoria, you know, broadly rural Victoria, seems to be one of the few places in Australia where that pertains. So Castlemaine is a kind of an artifact of that. But I've researched one particular character extensively, who one day down the track I'm going to write a book about, a guy who originated in Melbourne, then went to Cambridge University to study, and ended up living in Boston in the United States. But people during his education and later on in Boston would refer to his Australian accent. Now, he was born in Melbourne in 1855. So what did his Australian accent sound like to the English? And I imagine the Americans thought he sounded like more like an Englishman, but the English recognised that he had an Australian accent. So, he was the son of people from Leeds. So you can imagine what their accent would have sounded like, that very strong northern accent. He was their Melbourne-born son. So, yeah, you know, what did he sound like?
Extraordinary.
I'd just loved it. If I could go back in time, that's a place I'd like to go to hear that.
I will be honest. I wouldn't want to place. I'd be at the Eureka Stockade. I am worried I'm going to lose the connections are jumping around. But if you ever have a moment, do get on eBay or any number of the places you can buy books online. Buy Bear Brass, which is an amazing book about the how would you describe Bear Brass quickly? Because that for me is my favorite of your books.
Well, Bear Brass is the history of Melbourne, my history of Melbourne before the gold rush, but it kind of flicks in and out of fiction and non-fiction and tries to place you in particular spots in Melbourne and then fade to grey and take you to what was happening there in 1837 or something. So, yeah, it's Melbourne before the gold rush.
An excellent job of it too. Nothing but gold they're talking about. City Lost and Found is about Wheel and the Wrecker and so many other books. Thank you so much for joining me, Robin. I've thoroughly enjoyed this on a personal
Roy,
level.
Roy, it's a pleasure.
I hope that it's something that the listeners can get something out of. You've been listening to The Dawn of Crime. Make sure you check out also Robin's own podcast, which is Nothing on TV. And it's a fantastic listen. Thank you so much.